This is White Sox Weekly. Your all-access pass to everything White Sox.
Swing and a drive! Deep to left! Gone!
That was as hard as a baseball can be hit by anybody.
White Sox Weekly on the home of the White Sox, ESPN Chicago.
Now, here's your host, Jeff Mellor.
Good afternoon. Happy Saturday, White Sox fans. I know you had a fantastic week, no doubt about it, especially when you consider that the last time we convened here on White Sox Weekly, the Sox had just finished off a 5-1 week. And I did say to begin last week's show that it was nearly perfect. But of course, I was just ever so slightly perturbed by the fact that the Sox had dropped the first of their three-game series against the Chicago Cubs at Wrigley Field last Saturday. But boy, oh boy, how things change. What a majestical week it was. White Sox 4-2 this past week. And they continue, I think, to surprise a lot of people around baseball, maybe even a lot of White Sox fans. Feel free. I do have to say, I like the 12:30 time slot. Don't get a lot of these because in order to be on at this time, White Sox Weekly, we always precede the pregame coverage, which starts a half an hour, or I guess 40 minutes prior to first pitch. And because of that, we need essentially a 3:05, 3:10 first pitch and don't have a ton of those. During the season, it's usually either 1:10 or 6:10. At least those are the majority. Today, a 3:05 first pitch in San Francisco, which means smack dab in the middle of the afternoon, taking your White Sox calls today, 312-332-3776. So first question to the people out there, if you'd like, let me know. Have you been surprised by what the White Sox have done here in the first 50 games, 26-24? They're on pace to win 84 games. We're just four games shy of being a third of the way through the baseball season. So even though it may still feel early, we're rolling into a third of the way through the season right now, which is, I think, when you can start to really look at your team and say, okay, do we have something here? And I think the White Sox have proven now over an extended period of time that we may just have something. And of course, I'm sure Sox fans have been very excited about the fact that despite the loss last Friday, they were able to bounce back and provide the fan base with some temporary bragging rights, at least until August, for the City Crown. And it started last Saturday with one of the M&M boys getting things going in the right way.
That ball is smashed in the air to left center, and it's a three-run homer. Miguel Vargas on the board.
This is the dream start for the White Sox.
Indeed it was, DJ. The Sox jumped on the Cubs in the first inning last Saturday, thanks to Miguel Vargas and what was his 11th home run of the season, three-run bomb. And then things just got better quickly in the third inning. Munetaka Murakami to the dish.
Swinging a high fly ball out into left center. It is deep and it is gone. Murakami with number 16.
He makes it look easy, like it's no effort at all.
And of course, if Murakami's homering, Miggy's homering, you have to imagine Colson Montgomery was sitting in the dugout thinking to himself, man, listen, I got to get me one of those. And sure enough, he maybe had the most impressive one of the night.
Thursday off, and he pummels one deep to right. If it's fair, it's gone. It is a home run for Montgomery. That one almost went over the foul pole and right. 5-0.
I believe that hit off the club level beyond the foul pole. I've never seen one hit in that area. I believe that hit the windows or just below the windows in the club area. That was an absolute mashed potato. I mean, Lynn, I've seen one person hit one up there in the windows area in batting practice. That was Bonds. And now Colson Montgomery did it.
How about that? Colson Montgomery launching I mean, absolutely launching a bomb off of the window near the stadium club in right field, was able to hook it and keep it fair, and just an absolute missile. And as you heard DJ say there, he can only remember seeing one other person hit that spot at right field, and it was Barry Bonds in batting practice. Now, obviously don't have the exacts, you know, to confirm how many guys may or may not have done it in batting practice, but it was impressive nonetheless. And to come against your crosstown rivals certainly would make it that much more memorable. But Munetaka Murakami was not to be outdone by Colson. Just because he hit a long home run, didn't mean that Munetaka Murakami couldn't add a second.
Murakami in the air, a high and deep drive, right center field, number two tonight. 7-0.
I mean, absolute bomb. When Pete Crow Armstrong just starts a jog and looks straight up in the sky, you know it's uncatchable.
Oh, it was a beautiful thing to see. White Sox, with that home run, had tied their season high, 4 home runs on a game. And Andrew Benintendi figured, why not make it a season high with Jameson Taillon still on the mound?
Pitch is hammered deep to right and gone. Number 5 tonight for the White Sox. Andrew Benintendi gets in on the act. It's 8-1.
So there you go. White Sox win the Saturday night affair at right field against the Cubs in a laugher. And I will point out, as much fun as the home runs were, the one play that maybe stood out to me the most was a Colson Montgomery barehanded stab. And he makes a sensational defensive play, and I think is maybe answering some questions that people had about his defensive ability at shortstop.
The 0-1 is chopped softly to short, tough play. Barehanded pick Montgomery, and he got him at first. Oh, what a play.
Come on. Home run hitting, slugging shortstop with the bare hand, full speed grab, off balance throw on the money. I mean, why not just do it all?
And, of course, it was a fantastic game all around, not just for Colson Montgomery, but the entire White Sox team. Davis Martin pitched last Saturday against the Cubs, went 6 innings, 1 earned run, 7 strikeouts, picked up his 6th victory of the season, and just continued mowing down hitters. So it was a fabulous Saturday night for folks out there, only, though, to be outdone by what awaited us on Sunday. As White Sox fans, you know where I'm going. It's been a long week, but it has been a fun week. And with the Cubs jumping out early in that one on Sunday, the White Sox continued to do what they normally do all season long, and that is battle their way back. Cubs jumped out to a 3-0 lead in the first. White Sox picked up a couple in the second and fourth. Cubs added one to their lead to make it 4-2. And the White Sox in the fifth, we had a play that Pete Crow Armstrong did his best to make a play on, but Miguel Vargas had a little too much oomph for PCA.
The kick and the pitch. Swing and a fly ball out into right center. Crow Armstrong going back. And he makes an attempt, and he can't get it. It's off the fence. One run in. Here comes the tying run. 4-4. Crow Armstrong got all the way back there, made a leap right in front of the patio, and just could not haul it in.
Yes, and obviously there were some other circumstances going on that play that have headlined the week. We can talk about that if you would like. I'd prefer, though, to focus mainly on the field because the White Sox have been so much fun. I don't want to take away from that aspect of it. And, of course, we're tied up at 4, and then we move to the bottom of the 8th. What, for a moment, felt like an epic, epic home run by Tristan Peters. For a lot of White Sox fans out there, he might be one of the more anonymous players on this roster, and he announced himself with authority last Sunday.
And the pitch. Peters in the air, out into right. It's deep. It is gone. A 3-run homer. Tristan Peters with his first home run. Unbelievable.
That was impressive, folks. Unfortunately, for the White Sox, Sir Anthony Dominguez, the Knight, was not able to come in and lock it down in the 9th. And of course, I think a lot of Sox fans, if you were like me, were sweating it a little bit when Michael Conforto sent this game into extras.
3-1. Swing and a fly ball well hit to center. Acuna back. He's at the fence. It's gone and we're tied. That is a 3-run homer for Michael Conforto.
I will say this. That added to the drama. It certainly made the event that much more memorable when we know the way the outcome eventually would head. But at the time, it was a huge stomach punch. The Cubs in the top of the 10th would bring home their Manfred man, that ghost runner at second. However, you have to give huge props to Tyler Davis for navigating through a bases loaded jam and only allowing that lead runner to score, which ultimately allowed Edgar Caro to play the role of hero last Sunday afternoon. And I'm trying to think, I think it was probably the best moment for White Sox fans since Tim Anderson's walk-off home run in the Field of Dreams game. If I'm wrong, you can correct me. But for me, that was the last time I remember feeling this euphoric about a White Sox regular season game.
Tying run at third. Caro hits a fly ball out into deep left center field. It's back there. It is gone! Edgar Caro wins it!
Shut up! Yes! The young man deserves it.
Ah, how good did that feel? White Sox fans, how good that did that feel to you? Feel free to share the euphoria with me today. Again, we didn't have a chance to really recap that. Well, we did on the postgame show, but now I've got a little bit of an extended period of time to talk with you. So I'm opening up the phone lines and inviting you to give us a call. I got Hannah LaMotta on the board here today for White Sox Weekly. She is a diehard White Sox fan, and Aiden O'Connor is still hanging out too. So maybe he can chime in as well. Hannah, give me your thoughts. Come on. How did you feel? Because you went to the game at Raitt Field on Friday night, and obviously Sox fans knew that that one hurt. Because you hate to lose the series opener. You always feel like you're chasing the series at that moment. And I know you can tell me, for Sox fans, that series, okay, it's just a regular season series, but it means more. So how did it feel finally on Sunday afternoon watching that unfold to you?
Yeah, it didn't feel the best on Friday, but as the weekend went on, watching that on Sunday was one of those moments. It was kind of like a core memory. I was watching with my dad. And you're like, there's no way something crazy could happen. There's no way. And we got up and we screamed so loud. And I don't think either of us have ever screamed that loud for a regular season game ever.
Sure.
Ever. I don't like even Field of Dreams. Yeah. But like this just meant something. I think that the whole series and all of the buildup and just everything that had been going on in that game prior, and it just made it such a special moment. And I genuinely think that's probably like one of the moments I'll never forget watching. And, you know, we the neighbors were also watching, but they were like a minute behind outside.
And they're White Sox fans too?
There was like half Cubs, half White Sox.
Okay.
So
house divided.
They were cheering, like all the Cubs fans were being obnoxious and cheering, but they were so behind. So we would hear, you know, like when the Conforto home run happened, mm-hmm. we heard it like a minute later and they were going crazy. So the reason we kind of cheered so loud was kind of like to spoil it for them in a way, mm-hmm. because we just stood up.
Yeah.
My dad was getting so annoyed. He's like, they're just being so annoying. So then he got up and the windows were wide open. And then after it happened, they screamed over. They're like, you guys spoiled it. I'm like, sorry. But yeah, it was an amazing, amazing memory to have.
I love that. Aiden, how about you? Obviously, you are a diehard Sox fan as well. What was your feeling? Was it euphoric when you saw Caro hit the walk-off? Did you know immediately that it was gone, or were you kind of waiting and seeing on it?
I didn't know right away it was gone. It looked like it was in the gap, but either way, you would think that tied the game.
Yeah.
You know, walk-off home runs are cool. They're always cool no matter what. Against the Cubs, it means a little bit more. And for our generation, for Hannah and I, when you think about it, the best memory against the Cubs for us, honestly, for me, the first thing that came to my mind was a Tyler Saladino walk-off single.
Mm-hmm.
So to make it a home run and a guy like Edgar Caro that's been struggling early in the season to kind of turn that around, it was awesome.
I think that encapsulates it well. Aiden and Hannah both in their early 20s. For them, the best moment of their lives against the Cubs that they really can remember. Core memory for Hannah. So good stuff. If you want to share your thoughts about beating the Cubs, we can go ahead and do that this week, of course. I'm also going to focus on the rest of the week as well. Plenty to talk about. And I've got an interesting call from Zach on the South Side. Zach, be patient. I'm going to take a quick timeout. We'll get back to you. But it's something that I wanted to address anyway. So when we come back, I'll bring Zach on, who has to bring up something that a lot of White Sox fans are wondering about. And I think it's worth a conversation. 312-332-3776. I'm Jeff Meller. This is White Sox Weekly on the home of the Sox, ESPN 1000 and the Hard Rock Casino White Sox Network.
Carmen and Yurko, weekdays, 9 to noon, ESPN Chicago.
Swing and a miss, strike three. Here it comes. Swing and a miss, strike three.
I love it.
And a swing and a miss, strike three. Ball game over. Grant Taylor strikes out the side. They get two in the ninth and win it.
That was Tuesday night. Grant Taylor locks down his first save of the season in dominant fashion, as you heard right there. Len Casper, Darren Jackson on the call here on your home of the White Sox, ESPN 1000. Taylor came on in the ninth with the White Sox leading 2-1 in a game that they had trailed 1-0 for the entire eight innings leading up to the top of the ninth, when the White Sox were able to push across a couple of runs. And then Will Venable called on Grant Taylor, who had not been used yet, and was able to watch him just dominate the Seattle Mariners in the bottom of the ninth, which leads to, I think, a question that a lot of White Sox fans are pondering, and something that Zach on the South Side wants to bring up. So perfect opportunity to do so. Zach, good afternoon. Welcome. This is White Sox Weekly. I'm Jeff Meller, and jump aboard, man.
Good afternoon.
What's up, buddy? Good, man.
Thanks for taking my call.
Thanks for making it.
Yeah, I just been like watching the games, and I was happy when I seen that he finally put Grant Taylor in as the closer, because Sir Dominguez, he's just not it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
He gets in there when it needs to be saved. He gets in there and he falls. He's like he's scared when he get in there. He doesn't attack the hitters like Grant Taylor did, that like you say, and when he played Seattle, he went in there and took care of business. He got down to it, made it happen. He gets in there and it seems like he's nervous all the time.
So yeah, thank you for the call, Zach. And it's something that I was going to address anyway and just have the conversation. Do White Sox fans want Will Venable to ultimately move Grant Taylor into the closer's role? Now, I don't think Sir Anthony Dominguez is nervous in those situations. He's been in the league for a while now. He's a 31-year-old. He's somebody who's been in the game for, you know, eight seasons. So it's not like this isn't something that he hasn't seen before. He has at times been the closer for his team, most prominently probably in his rookie season when he was with the Phillies, when he set his career high of 16 saves back in 2018. Now, since then, he's never been able to quite duplicate the control that he once had. And that, you know, is potentially the biggest issue for Sir Anthony Dominguez as a closer, is that he cannot necessarily avoid the walks at the rate you would like your closer to do. The question for me, not so much, I think everybody who follows the Sox would all agree, Grant Taylor is your most dominant electric arm out of the bullpen. He is the guy who you feel most confident is going to be able to shut down a team when he's called upon. The question for me really is not should Grant Taylor be the closer, but more what do you lose if you want to put the capital C closer role on Grant Taylor, and the flexibility that you are potentially losing if you move him there? Because I'm not saying you have to use your quote closer in the ninth inning all the time, but once you make that move, for the most part, the guy who is the closer, the rest of the team kind of assumes that in the save situations, he's going to be getting the ball. And it becomes a little bit more difficult to use that guy against the in the highest leverage situations. And that is the one thing that's holding me back from proclaiming, yes, Grant Taylor needs to be the closer of the White Sox. Because certainly what we saw on Tuesday night against the Mariners in a one-run game, I wanted Grant Taylor coming into that game, and I was absolutely ecstatic that Will Venable chose to go to him. It was honestly not even a question in my mind that he was going to go to him because he had been warming in the pen, and it was kind of a no-brainer because Sir Anthony Dominguez had not been that you were going to use Taylor in that situation. So that made all the sense in the world to me. Now, are you potentially, though, losing your ability to utilize Grant Taylor in the sixth, seventh, or eighth inning at times if you're going to go ahead and make him your closer? And I would say you potentially are. And here's the thing about Sir Anthony Dominguez. Maybe you don't feel super confident with him in a one-run game, but generally if it's a two- or three-run lead, I'm pretty comfortable with Sir Anthony Dominguez finding a way to get through most of those safe situations. Now, listen, it's not ideal. He's not, you know, the perfect lockdown closer, but part of me likes the idea of saying, hey, if it's a two- or three-run lead, by all means, you know, let's save Sir Anthony Dominguez for those situations right now. And you can utilize Grant Taylor earlier in games when needed against, you know, tougher pockets of the lineup. That's kind of where my head's at. The only thing, though, that's starting to maybe get me to at least consider it a little bit more is when you start to look at what Grant Taylor has been able to do over the last month. He has in the last 30 days thrown 14 innings, has not allowed an earned run, has only allowed 11 hits and 4 walks. So that is a whip of 1.07, so darn near 1. And he's also struck out 22 hitters over that 14-inning stretch in the last 30 days. That is a Mason Miller-esque run that he has put together over the last month. And I'll also add, he has still yet to allow a home run in his big league career. Probably doesn't come as much of a surprise to anybody who has watched or kept close tabs on Grant Taylor, but now he's finally kind of figuring it out and he is dominating. And the question is, can he be Mason Miller? And if he is that good, then I think it's fair to have the conversation, should he be utilized as the closer? And again, it's hard to say definitively yes, because I still feel like I'm almost cool having him in the seventh and eighth inning against tougher matchups and then turning the ball over to Sir Anthony Dominguez with a two or three run lead in a safe situation. And in a one run game, fine. Maybe I'm going to save those situations for Grant Taylor. And granted, I understand that's probably not extremely fair to Grant Taylor, but the truth is that playing baseball is not fair. It's really what can you do to help the team win? And he's probably most valuable in this extreme fireman role where Will Venable can go to him in the most dire situations and not necessarily have to reserve him for the ninth inning. So that's kind of where my head's at right now. Like, chip in with the occasional one run saves when needed, if you don't have to use him earlier in the game. Otherwise, if it's a 2-3 run lead, then maybe I use Taylor earlier in the game and trust that Sir Anthony Dominguez can get through it with a little bit of cushion. That's kind of where I've landed on this. But if you disagree, you want to have a conversation about it, we can do that. Again, this is White Sox Weekly, 312-332-3776. Hey, Sox fans, join us at the ballpark on Memorial Day. That's Monday, May 25th, as the White Sox take on the Twins at 1:10. 10,000 fans at the ballpark will receive a Chase Mydroth bobblehead presented by the Village of Bedford Park. To purchase tickets and prepaid parking, visit whitesox.com/promos. When we come back, I still owe you some recap from the week. We got through the Cubs series, and obviously I'll still take your calls on that if you'd like to bask in the glory of a win over the crosstown rivals. But I do want to also recap some of the Seattle Mariners series and last night's action, the Friday Night Lights that we were watching. We'll do that when we come back right here on ESPN 1000.
The Rich Eisen Show, weekdays, noon to 2, ESPN Chicago.
Jeff Meller hanging out with you on White Sox Weekly every Saturday, 2 hours prior to our pregame coverage beginning, which officially will start at 2:30 today with a 3:05 first pitch. Before we get you into some conversation real quick, let's pause 10 seconds for stations to identify themselves.
This is ESPN Chicago, home of the White Sox. WMVP WTBC HD2 Chicago, a Good Karma Brands radio station.
Sox fans, join us for $5 Tuesdays. All fans will enjoy a specially priced $5 concessions menu, including draft beers from Miller Lite or Modelo, Garrett Popcorn Stadium Buttery, Vienna Beef Hot Dogs or Polish Sausages, Beggar's Pizza Slices, Nachos, and select Coca-Cola products. To purchase tickets, visit whitesox.com/Tuesdays. All right, a couple of pieces of housekeeping to get you informed before we get into our next topic, but the White Sox will use Brian Hudson as an opener today. The 6'8" lefty has been a real revelation for the White Sox this year. He carries a 1.57 ERA into today's game. He will be the opener, then followed by Eric Fetty after Hudson is done, as Fetty will be the bulk man today. And the White Sox also placed Jordan Hicks on the 15-day injured list prior to the start of today's game with a right lat strain. They recalled right-hander Jordan Leisure from Clash AAA Charlotte as the corresponding move. Leisure is 0-0 with a 2.08 ERA, 5 strikeouts in 4 relief appearances in Charlotte since he was optioned back on May 7th. Of course, up here in the big leagues, Leisure was struggling. He went 2-1 with a 6.06 ERA, 17 strikeouts over 16 outings with the White Sox earlier this season. So they recall Jordan Leisure as they place Jordan Hicks on the injured list. And I think it's worth noting, because I've had this call a couple of days in a row now on the postgame show about why won't the White Sox call up Ben Peoples, who has been dominant in AAA. And the answer, I think, is pretty simple. It's that Ben Peoples is not on the White Sox active 40-man roster right now. And so in order for them to promote Ben Peoples to the major leagues, they would have to find room on that roster, which means they would have to release somebody off of that. And the truth is, part of what we're seeing here today with the recalling of Jordan Leisure and the placing of Jordan Hicks on the injured list, this is kind of how modern baseball works. You are allowed to carry 13 pitchers on your 26-man roster, and essentially the way major league teams skirt that idea that they, you know, can only carry 13 pitchers, what they do is they essentially have a plethora of arms, usually at AAA, who they have options remaining, who they can kind of shuttle back and forth between AAA and the majors. We've seen that, you know, numerous times with, and trust me, the White Sox are not the only team. In fact, pretty much every team in baseball does this nowadays. But the White Sox, we've seen it, you know, with guys like Brandon Iser, right? Like Tyler Schweitzer. We're seeing it with, you know, Leisure today. And there's just, if a player has options remaining as a relief pitcher, then you better believe that unless they're absolutely dominant and lights out, they're probably going to be one of those players who's ticketed to go back and forth, right? And the White Sox also have Chris Murphy, Tyler Gilbert right now in the minor leagues as some of those arms who they can call upon when needed. And, you know, the truth is that, you know, someone like, you know, Brandon Isert, Tyler Davis, if they're not performing, or if even, you know, even more unfortunate, if they have like a heavy workload where they happen to throw, you know, 35, 40 pitches in an outing, you know, they might just send them down knowing that they're not going to be able to really call upon them. So it's just the game that's played. And so because of that, to utilize your full 40-man roster as a team, you know, a player like Ben Peoples, you better be committed to letting someone else, one of those players, go off of your 40-man roster, knowing that Peoples is ready. And then the question is he going to just step in and immediately make himself an arm in that pen, which is odd. You'd think, oh, I absolutely want a guy who's a, you know, a definite lockdown reliever in my pen, but it can sometimes play with your flexibility a little bit if he's almost too good, where you never want to option him down to the minors because, you know, you don't, you're obviously, you don't want to ruffle feathers inside your clubhouse if a player is absolutely, you know, performing. But at the same time, you know, if your bullpen gets taxed and all of a sudden you're locked in with a full complement of eight relievers, none of whom you really want to ever option to the minors. It's a weird little game that you almost need that flexibility because of the way starting pitchers are not really asked to go deep anymore in today's game. And so it's just, if you're going to make the move to Peoples, you better make sure that whoever you're cutting ties with, you have no use for. And that's kind of the way modern baseball works, is you're hoarding all these assets on your 40-man roster, and you don't necessarily want to push a guy into that spot. So that is a long-winded way of answering the Ben Peoples question, which I have gotten a couple times here in the last few days. All right, so I did want to recap, though, a couple things from this week that we haven't got to. So the White Sox did take they took one of three from the Mariners. Unfortunately, the Mariners got two there. The Mariners are still a good baseball team, even though the record doesn't necessarily reflect it. You go through their lineup, and even without Cal Raleigh, the Mariners I still look at as one of the lineups that I fear, you know, more than most in the American League. You know, there's very few easy outs up and down that lineup when you've got, you know, Arozarena, Julio Rodriguez, you know, you've got Josh Naylor, and who is even, you know, he's obviously the best player ever when he's playing the White Sox. So, you know, you've always got to deal with that. And they've also recently added Colt Emerson, their top prospect, their top hitting prospect, number three in all of baseball. The White Sox were unfortunate enough to actually allow his first hit, which actually was a home run, by the way.
The 2-2. Hook deep right field, and it is a home run for the kid. His first major league hit. Colt Emerson at age 20 bags a three-run homer in the second game of his career.
So that was on Monday night, the White Sox first game in Seattle, and that kind of blew the game open against the Mariners. And when the White Sox were playing them in Seattle earlier this week, and the Mariners ended up winning that game pretty handily, and the White Sox, though, would bounce back in the second game of that series, and that actually was the game that Grant Taylor closed out that I was talking a little bit about earlier, when the White Sox were able to manufacture a couple of runs in the ninth to come back and beat the Mariners.
Runners go. The pitch is outside, and no throw. Oh, that's big. A double steal. The pitch. Mydroth hits ground ball into right base, hit. Hill will score. Vargas stops at third. Mydroth on his way to second as that throw ended up coming in from right to home plate. 1-1 and second and third. Infield in, tie game. Benintendi the batter. He hits a ground ball off the glove of Naylor. Everybody safe. Vargas scores. Sox lead 2-1. Infield hit, Andrew Benintendi. Swing and a miss, strike three. Here it comes. Swing and a miss, strike three.
I love it.
And a swing and a miss, strike three. Ball game over. Grant Taylor strikes out the side. They get two in the ninth and win it.
So that was the one game that the White Sox were able to grab in Seattle. Wednesday afternoon, the Sox were not able to pick up the series. And that game was certainly interesting. So the White Sox played small ball a little bit as Sam Antonacci stole second, which led to Andrew Benintendi bringing him home for the White Sox first run of that game to tie it up at one. Munetaka Murakami would retie the game up at two with an RBI single, and that led to this sequence in the top of the sixth when the White Sox had an opportunity to go ahead in a 2-2 ball game, and Drew Romo at the plate with runners on first and third, Chase Mydroth, the runner on third, and it looked like somebody missed a sign.
The pitch, he squares, and he takes a ball, and now they got Mydroth caught in a rundown, and he's tagged out by Pareda. Mm. Out number two.
So that proved costly because Chase Mydroth was caught when Drew Romo did not put down a safety squeeze, and in Romo's defense, the ball was high and outside, out of the zone. So it would have been, honestly, a very difficult bunt to get down, if anything, just to make contact. And so he pulled it back, and that's where Chase Mydroth. And I will also defend Chase Mydroth in this situation. When the safety squeeze is on, he's doing his best to get a good secondary lead to ensure that if the bunt gets down and it's close, Chase Mydroth wants to make sure that he ends up being safe at home. And it's almost a no-win situation for him, because you can say you need to get back on that, but if he's going to get back, then he's probably not going to get a great secondary lead. So it's kind of a no-win situation there. White Sox get caught in a tough position Wednesday afternoon, and then that led to the Mariners kind of busting it open.
The lefty delivers, swing and a fly ball, well hit deep left, and it's a home run. Can you believe it? The number nine hitter, Johnny Pareda, gives the Mariners a 3-2 lead in the seventh.
Now that would not have been so terrible had Jordan Hicks been able to get Randy Arozarena out with a runner on.
The set and the 0-1. Swinging a fly ball out into deep left center field. Antonacci at the wall. That's a home run. Randy Arozarena with a two-run blow makes it 5-2 Seattle.
Now the Sox would plate one on a throwing error by the Mariners, which did set up the White Sox with an opportunity in the ninth, down 5-3. Will Venable, he summoned Randall Grichuk as a pinch hitter, and Grichuk would do this.
First pitch, Grichuk swings and hits a fly ball out into deep right, still back. It is gone. How did that get out of here?
Strong man hit it.
It's a one-run game, 5-4.
But that's how it would end, and the White Sox would lose the series. Randall Grichuk, his second pinch hit home run of the season. He has now tied Derek Hill for the most pinch hit home runs on the White Sox, as both have two, which means the White Sox have a total of four pinch hit home runs so far this season. That does lead all of baseball. All right, so I've recapped for you the Cubs series. We recapped what went down midweek against the Mariners. Now we have to get to a fantastic way to start a series in San Francisco last night. We'll do that when we come back. Hey, Sox fans, create your own game plan with a 10-ticket flex pack. The pick, you pick the matchups and the seats. Total freedom, total fun. For more information, visit whitesox.com/ticket plans or call or text 312-674-1000. I'm Jeff Meller. This is White Sox Weekly on ESPN 1000.
Captain Jay Hood, weekday morning, 6 to 9, ESPN Chicago.
Jeff Meller back here on White Sox Weekly ahead of our pregame coverage, which will begin at 2:30. White Sox and Giants first pitch coming your way at 3:05 this afternoon. It'll be Brian Hudson, the opener for the White Sox today. He'll be followed by Eric Fetty, and the Giants will send old friend Adrian Houser to the mound. Houser, of course, was excellent with the White Sox in his stint with them last season. So good, in fact, that they were able to flip him at the trade deadline to the Tampa Bay Rays in exchange for Curtis Mead and another prospect. And Houser pitched so well last year that he was able to earn himself a nice payday from the Giants, although he has not necessarily been able to repeat the success from last year, as, again, Houser now has a 5.25 ERA on the season for the Giants. I will say, for the Giants, it has been a pretty abysmal year all season long, and perhaps it doesn't really even start with the pitching. It's probably the lineup, which is the bigger issue for them, which it's filled with, I'll say former stars, right? Because I think everybody is fairly familiar with Luis Arraez's 3 batting titles to his name, but of course he has his own deficiencies. He does a nice job with the batting average, but as a whole, as a player, does he sometimes leaving you want a little bit more? Because I will say this, Arraez is hitting .321 this year, and that's almost like the bare minimum for what he needs to do a lot of times, because he doesn't really draw too many walks, and so he almost has to be, like, .300 isn't really good enough sometimes from Arraez. He needs to be in that, you know, .315 plus to really give you a solid batting average, because he doesn't really provide a lot of pop. Defensively, he can be suspect at times at second base. That's a lot of why he's, you know, kind of been bandied back and forth between second and first base throughout his career. But then, so he's a name you know, and it looks good on the lineup card, but not necessarily as productive as you would like. The Giants paid a huge sum to Willie Adames to be their shortstop last free agency, and he had a good year last year, but he's been a little bit below what you usually get from him. He did last season become the first San Francisco Giant to hit 30 home runs since Barry Bonds did it. The last Giant player to do it was Barry Bonds, and Willie Adames hit 30. It's been, you know, tough sledding in Oracle Park, as that park does really suppress some power. And so Adames to get to 30 last year was impressive. But when you go through the rest of the lineup and you look at someone like Raffy Devers, right? They made a huge trade to acquire him. He had a huge $300 million contract that the Red Sox gave him, and they almost immediately wanted to get off of it because of the, you know, defensive liability that Devers was at third base. They asked him to move to first base last year to accommodate Alex Bregman. He didn't want to do that in the middle of the season, and so all of a sudden there was acrimony, and so the Red Sox jettisoned him to San Francisco. Interestingly enough, the Red Sox got a pretty talented young left-handed pitcher in that deal in Kyle Harrison. The problem was that the Red Sox could not wait to develop him, and they flipped him almost immediately this offseason to the Brewers for Caleb Durbin, who they all of a sudden needed to replace Alex Bregman, who left. So the Red Sox having some issues, but and then, by the way, if you haven't noticed, Kyle Harrison would be the ace on most teams if it wasn't for the fact that the Brewers have Jacob Mizorowski, who just has stopped giving up runs in baseball. He's gone all of May without allowing a run. So that guy's pretty good. He throws 103 miles an hour as a starter, so he's pretty nasty. Anyway, I digress. So you've got Adames, you've got Arraez, you've got Devers, you've got names you've heard of. Oh, and Matt Chapman. Matt Chapman has hit at least 21 home runs in 4 of the last 5 seasons, and entering play today, Chapman has 1 home run. So virtually everywhere you look up and down the Giants lineup, they are struggling to hit home runs and to score runs, and that has been kind of the crux of their issue. Not necessarily Adrian Hauser not living up to his free agent deal, but Hauser is on the mound today. Hopefully the White Sox can keep it rolling and take advantage of his tough start to the season. They being the White Sox, did a nice job of small ball last night against the Giants in the 4th inning. Now, what was somewhat odd was Trevor McDonald, the Giants starter, mowed through the White Sox lineup the first time through the order. 9 up, 9 down. He was absolutely just dominating the White Sox. But then when you hear the idea of, hey, what is the second and third time through the order penalty? What does that mean? Well, let me tell you. You definitely got the full extreme of what it was for Trevor McDonald last night when the White Sox got their second look at the Giants starter in the 4th inning. He started the inning by hitting Sam Antonacci, which, by the way, was Antonacci's 9th time being plunked this season in the majors. And then Munetaka Murakami, the next hitter, was also beaned. So you've got runners on first and second, nobody out. Now Miguel Vargas flies out. Then Colson Montgomery draws a walk. So there's the bases are then loaded, and all of a sudden, Trevor McDonald, who had no problems through the first three, finds himself in a huge situation, and that led to the White Sox picking up their first run of the ball game when Chase Meidroth came to the plate.
The 3-1. It is outside ball four. That'll force home a run. Antonacci is looking at the third base umpire, now decides to trot home. It's 1-0.
All right, so 1-0. That's good. Good start for the White Sox. You're thinking, and you've got the bases loaded still with one out, so let's add on here, and that's exactly what Andrew Benintendi did.
A swing and a line drive, base hit. Left center field. Murakami scores. Here comes Montgomery to the plate. Benintendi with a two-run double. 3-0.
You are truly watching White Sox baseball right now at its best.
And they would keep adding on. Now, this one, you have to give an assist to the Giants. And I'll be honest, I went on a whole diatribe about Luis Arias' defense, and I wasn't even thinking about this play. But it does now occur to me that the White Sox fourth run was in large part thanks to Luis Arias.
The 3-1. He is hit on the ground. Diving stop by Arias. He's going to throw to the plate, and Meidroth scores. That was not a forced play. So Arias just fired to the catcher, Rodriguez, out in front of the plate, and Rodriguez didn't even move.
Wasn't close. It was a poor decision by Arias on that play. He should have taken the out at first. But that kept the inning alive, and Derek Hill would continue to add on.
Hill pokes the ground ball into right. Benintendi will score. Caro stops at second, and it's 5-0.
So 5-0, and the White Sox still have opportunities here. Now, this didn't score a run, but it was a unique play because Sam Antonacci, batting for the second time in the fourth inning, had this happen again.
Big leg kick and a 1-0, and Antonacci got hit again.
Now, you don't see that every day.
Two hit by pitches in one inning.
That's it. So the 10th batter of the inning has been plunked for a second time, led off the inning and came around to score. Now he just loads the bases this time around. Oh, my.
Pretty wild. For the 10th time now this season, Sam Antonacci has been hit by a pitch. He is the third player since 2014 to get hit by a pitch twice in one inning. And he's, again, now been hit 10 times, as I mentioned. That is huge when it comes to having that ability as a leadoff hitter. I need to emphasize this because part of the reason why Sam Antonacci has fit in, I wouldn't even say seamlessly, but he's added an element to the lineup now as the leadoff hitter because he now holds a .390 on base percentage. And think about that. That is in 104 at bats. And, you know, being hit 10 times, that's essentially drawing 10 walks when you want to look at it statistically, because it obviously doesn't count as an at-bat when you're hit by a pitch. So he has 10 hit by pitches and 8 walks. He has been hit by he's been hit twice more than he's been walked. That's insane in 104 at-bats. And it is truly a skill. He has this ability where he starts to lean in almost like he's covering the plate, and then he kind of turns his body inward, which extends him further out across the plate. And so anything inside is definitely susceptible to clipping Sam Antonacci. And he has shown that it is truly a skill. And for a guy who's leading off, I mean, that's fantastic. So that was a unique play and a unique stat there. And then with a 5-0 lead and the bases loaded, Munetaka Murakami, well, guess what? No home run this time.
Boy, they could really break it open here.
Oh, man.
Murakami will get a timeout.
I'm just thinking about it. He's one of the few left-handers in the game probably that can, at this time of day, hit one into the seats in left field.
There's a swing and a line drive left field. That is a fair ball. It's going to get to the wall. Caro, Hill, and Antonacci will score. A 3-run double. 8-0.
Well, I think we both kind of contributed there, partner. As you just said, this is really an important time to break it wide open I was hoping it'd end up in the left field seats, but that works too.
Yes, it does. And one more for good measure. With that three-run double, the White Sox had scored 8 runs. That was a season high in an inning. Their previous high this year was against the Angels back on April 27th when they scored 7. And one more for good measure.
The 2-1, Vargas hits a ground ball to a backhanding Adames at short. Long throw to first under the glove of Devers. And a run will score. And it looked like Devers and Vargas came together just barely, and Vargas actually hit the deck beyond first base, but he's all right. And the Boo Birds are out here in San Francisco. It's 9-0.
An odd game, to say the least. And that's right. The White Sox scored 9 times.
9 times.
That's right. 9 times.
9 times.
That's right, Mrs. Bueller. 9 times in the fourth inning. And they would go on, cruise to victory, beating the Giants last night, 9-4. Davis Martin, actually, the only disappointing thing to me about last night's game was that his streak of 18 straight starts, or I guess appearances, because there were a couple games in there where Davis Martin had an opener in there for him. So 18 straight appearances where he had gone without allowing more than 3 earned runs. That was snapped last night after the Sox got up big 9-0. Martin eventually did allow 4 to come home in the game. And so that snapped that streak. But Davis Martin still good enough to earn his 7th victory of the season. He's now 7-1 with an ERA just a tick above 2. And if you ask me, I think you can go ahead and punch his ticket to the All-Star game in Philadelphia, because at this rate, it's going to be hard to see how Davis Martin would not make the All-Star game. 312-332-3776. That's the number if you want to jump aboard. I'm Jeff Meller on White Sox Weekly. Sox fans and also reggaeton music fans, join us at the ballpark on Friday, May 28th for reggaeton night. It is at the as the Sox take on the Tigers at 6:40. Get access to a pregame patio party with all you can eat and drink and a live DJ when you purchase a specially priced ticket. Limited availability. To purchase tickets and prepaid parking, visit whitesox.com/promos. Speaking of the Tigers, what the hell has happened to them? And man, will the Guardians ever lose again? We will put the AL Central in focus as we go around the majors as well. This is the ESPN 1000 Hard Rock Casino White Sox Network.
Jeff Meller takes your calls after the game, ESPN Chicago.
I do, after every White Sox game, post-game coverage. Jeff Meller here on White Sox Weekly every Saturday, 2 hours prior to the pregame show officially beginning. But like I always like to say, it's just extended pregame coverage for White Sox fans out there. Always willing to take your calls at 312-332-3776. Kids autograph sessions are back on Family Sundays, folks. Presented by Coca-Cola starting on May 31st. The first 125 kids to enter at Gate 5 will head to the Kids Zone mini field to receive autographs from some of their favorite players. Enjoy family-friendly activities. Kids get to run the bases, so much more. To learn more and purchase tickets, visit whitesox.com/Sunday. All right, so what is going on with the Detroit Tigers, who came into the season as the presumptive favorite to win the American League Central? Now, if you weren't locked in as to how exactly last season ended in the American League Central, you're forgiven, because you were just watching the White Sox, but not necessarily watching the top of the division. Well, the Detroit Tigers made the playoffs, but they did so with a historic collapse in the process. They gagged away a huge lead. I think it was something like 15 games near the, I don't have the exact date, but it was like 15 games by like August, you know, middle of August, the largest lead that a team had ever given up in that short a period of time. And the Guardians stalked them down, and it ended up winning the American League Central last season by 1 game. Now, the Tigers in some ways were able to at least redeem themselves because they advanced in the first round. But obviously that left a bitter taste in Tigers fans' mouth when ultimately they were not able to advance to the ALCS. And a lot of people believed that with the extra investment that they had added this year, they signed Framber Valdez to complement Tarek Skubal, and they brought in Kenley Jansen to help solidify their bullpen. So they went the extra mile to try and add on to a team that was for a good chunk of the season last year in control of the division until eventually it fell apart on them. However, they have been crushed by injuries, and Tarek Skubal at the forefront there. He, of course, had the scope on his elbow for the loose bodies. Now, interestingly, Skubal, according to his agent, Scott Boris, underwent a newer procedure, which I guess is going to have him back in a much quicker time. So Skubal may be returning. He actually, too, a couple days ago, threw a successful 35-pitch bullpen session. So he clearly is advancing much faster than probably most people originally anticipated when they heard the news that he had loose bodies in his elbow and was going to have to undergo a scope. But even though he will return quicker, the Tigers are currently in the midst of a 7-game losing streak, having suffered a mop at the hands of the Guardians. Mop, of course, the 4-game sweep, as coined by the good folks over at Baseball Barbiecast. They do great work. And yes, the Guardians mopped the Tigers earlier this week. We have two teams heading in drastically different directions to the point now where in the last couple of days, the question is not, hey, can the Tigers get back into this? The question is, are the Tigers going to be trading Tarek Skubal when he returns and proves that he's healthy? And it's a fair question because he is going to be a free agent at the end of the year. He's probably going to command a contract in excess of $300 million, having won back-to-back Cy Young awards. So he's going to be highly sought after. Teams like the Dodgers and Yankees are going to probably be big players, maybe the Mets. So when you're talking about the big money teams wanting in on that it's, you know, he's going to test free agency. So will the Tigers trade Skubal at the deadline? It would probably seem to be the most prudent move, but I guess a lot's going to depend on what exactly they can do over the next month or so here while they try and hold down the fort. And because I believe because since Skubal went down, the last I checked, the Tigers were something like 2-16 since Skubal got hurt. So it's not just that, you know, they're missing him, but there's some other key offensive pieces that have been struggling. And then conversely, because they were playing the Tigers, but not just because they were playing the Tigers, but also because they're a good baseball team. The Guardians are currently on a 7-game run, and they've also won 10 of their last 11. And they won last night on a pinch hit 9th-inning home run by Kyle Manzardo off of Joan Duran, the Phillies closer. After Christopher Sanchez, who has been, you know, one of the most dominant pitchers in baseball here, Christopher Sanchez of the Phillies extended his scoreless inning streak to an absurd 38 2/3 innings. And so he pitched last night 8 scoreless innings, and it was a scoreless game. And Don Mattingly turned it over to his closer, Duran, and the Guardians found a way yet again to win another baseball game. And what's a little bit concerning to me as a White Sox fan watching the Guardians do what they're doing, they're not just doing it in the traditional way where it's, hey, Jose Ramirez, and then, you know, a bunch of, cunning and guile and, you know, some spit holding it together. That's not how the Guardians are necessarily doing it. Ramirez is okay. He's actually, in terms of his on base is 359, but his batting average is just 236. He's usually closer to 270, 280. And the power is okay. He's got 8 homers. But what's interesting is the ancillary players that the Guardians have started to rely on. Your Angel Martinez, who prior to this year wasn't somebody who anybody was concerned about. He has definitely been much better this season for the Guardians. Chase DeLauder, who they called up and was on a rocket ship earlier in the season. Now he's fallen off a little bit, but he's still been productive. He's hitting 266 with 7 homers, 30 RBIs, and a 352 on base. And then Travis Bazzana, the number one overall pick in his draft class. He was in the Hagen Smith draft. He was called up earlier this year, and he's played 22 games now for the Guardians. He's got a 391 on base, and he has stolen 7 bases. He's added that extra element to the lineup. So all of a sudden, the Guardians are finding ways to be productive, and some of the lineup, they're starting to lengthen it out a little bit. So that is the concerning thing. And oh, by the way, they're also one of the best teams when it comes to suppressing runs. That's something they've always been good at. So when you look at their entire rotation, everybody gives them a decent chance. Gavin Williams, Parker Messick, you know, Slade Ciccone. Now, the weird thing is Tanner Bibee has actually been about as bad as he could be. He's 0-6 so far this season, even though he's got a 3.75 ERA. He's almost been like their Eric Fetty. So anyway, the AL Central, it's going to be interesting because the Guardians certainly don't look like they're going to stop anytime soon. And the Tigers, who was everybody's pick to win the American League Central to begin the season, they are in a free fall right now, trying to fight their way out of it and find some reason to keep Tarek Skubal around when he finally does return. Speaking of the Tigers, join us at the ballpark on Saturday, May 30th, as the White Sox take on the Tigers at 110. 15,000 fans, 21 and older, will receive a Kyle Teal and Edgar Caro bobblehead presented by Binney's Beverage Depot. To purchase tickets and prepaid parking, visit whitesox.com/promos. When we come back, we have a fun Twitter poll question today regarding something that is sweeping baseball nation. I'll tell you about it next right here on the ESPN 1000 Hard Rock Casino White Sox Network.
Hear Lennon DJ and High Def on 100.3 HD2.
Doing that thing again we saw in Seattle.
No. Not allowed. We are allowed to talk about it once.
It's a young group of fans out in left center called Strike. Doing the tarps off thing when they're waving their t-shirts in the air.
Put your shirts on.
It's cold.
Put them on. Nobody wants to see what you got showing. Oh, maybe there's some people, but still. I don't.
DJ has had enough of the tarps off phenomenon that is sweeping the nation. It has now followed the White Sox, I believe, in 3 separate locations, or is it just 2, Brennan?
I thought that it had happened at a Sox home game, but I can't find proof of that, okay. So I may be wrong.
Okay, so it definitely happened in Seattle earlier this week when the White Sox were there. And then last night in San Francisco, we were exposed to it.
And it's only a matter of time, right? Like, it's going to happen in Chicago, too.
It feels like it. I mean, it is sweeping the nation. If you're unfamiliar, if you haven't noticed yet, the tarps off phenomenon is something that started primarily, at least in baseball. Now, it occurred at Oklahoma State, I believe, years ago, but it caught on recently at a Cardinals game when Stephen F. Austin State University, their club baseball team, was in attendance, and it was a long rain delay game, and I think they ended up busting off their shirts and they started waving them over their heads like rally towels. And I believe the Cardinals came back and won that game. And Ali Marmol, the Cardinals manager, just loved their enthusiasm so much. He ended up, you know, bringing them back the next day and inviting them into the clubhouse, I believe, to celebrate.
You know what I think separates this too? Because I think we've seen, like, I can tell you for a fact, I know this happened at a White Sox game last year because I was watching it happen in the outfield. But I think what's kind of unique about this movement is that it's not, and I call it a movement.
Yeah, the tarp soft movement.
It's not like groups who go by themselves. It's groups of people who don't know each other.
Yes.
Coming together to make, some of these groups are crazy. They're like sections, plural.
Sure.
That's why this is so different.
There have been spots where it looks like we're talking about, you know, potentially hundreds and maybe even up into the thousands of fans in sections shirtless. I love the recap I'm reading on Yahoo where written by Mary Clark for The Win. She notes that it is, where was it here? It was a funny line that amused me. Mostly males taking off their shirts. I would say, yes, I agree. It's most, isn't it almost exclusively males? I have yet to see the moment where we have had female. And listen, I'm sure there's probably a few, but now you start to get into the area of lewdness and potentially public nudity where people will be arrested. Hannah's over there laughing. What's your thoughts on the tarps off movement, as Brennan has so dubbed it, Hannah?
It seems very frat boy.
Yes, very. Agreed.
And that's kind of why I think I'm past it. Maybe I would have found it more amusing maybe like 2 years ago or 3 years ago, but man, I'm too old for that.
If you were still in college, Hannah, yes, and you were like,
I would have been like, yeah, this is so funny, you know, like, but now I'm just like, what are we doing? But like, to each their own, have fun if you want, but just, I don't know. It provides some entertainment.
So to be clear, I wouldn't do this.
Okay.
I do think I think it is kind of cool that people who don't know each other are just joining in a section to create a giant group of people doing something stupid.
Yeah.
Like I think it's kind of cool.
Yeah, and it amuses me, and ultimately it's harmless. So that's why I'm kind of like, okay, this is, and it does get funny when all of a sudden it starts to grow, and all of a sudden it starts out early in the game with a couple, you know, maybe 20, 30 people, and all of a sudden by the 7th, 8th inning, you're looking up there and you're like, that's an entire section shirtless. What's going on here?
I will say the Mariners one was impressive.
Yes.
It was huge. And like they were, you could tell on the broadcast, they were actually making an impact with the chants and just like, you know, whatever they were doing out there. I was like, okay, yeah. Props.
I did actually catch, I actually went back and watched this because I'm always listening, obviously on road games. I'm back at our Chicago Board of Trade studios listening to Len and DJ do the broadcast, as I obviously will chime in occasionally in between innings with some things. So it's always, you know, I'm locked into them. But I did note that somebody mentioned that John Schriffen on CHSN noted in Seattle how they were a raucous crowd and they could give an SEC Saturday a run for its money. The funny thing is, sitting next to him as the color analyst that night was Gordon Beckham, who went to Georgia, and Beckham was just like, yeah, no. Beckham was like, I've seen SEC Saturdays. The tarps off movement in baseball stadiums is not an SEC Saturday. Jeff Meller here on White Sox Weekly. When we come back, we will be joined by Connor McKnight, who is in San Francisco, and he had a chance to take in Alcatraz yesterday with some members of the White Sox team. So I'm going to ask him how that went and find out what it would take to make Connor McKnight go tarps off in San Francisco. This is ESPN 1000.
Stream the games live on the ESPN Chicago app.
Big group of premium season ticket holders out here this weekend as well, catching the game tonight and tomorrow. That group toured Alcatraz today, and Connor McKnight joined.
Oh,
okay. Kind of goaded him into making that trip. He was invited. I did it back in 1999, and it's a thing you should do, and he did it, and he loved it.
Save all summer long with our summer savings section. Enjoy $20 weekday and $25 weekend select lower level tickets while supplies last. Exclusions apply, includes ticket taxes and fees. To purchase tickets, visit whitesox.com/section. Connor McKnight, my next guest. And real quick before I bring him in, a quick piece of business. Let's pause 10 for stations to identify themselves.
This is ESPN Chicago, home of the White Sox. WMVP WTBC HD2 Chicago, a Good Karma Brands radio station.
Connor McKnight, live from San Francisco, fresh off of a visit to Alcatraz. And I have to admit, Connor, my knowledge of Alcatraz is basically seeing the 1979 film Escape from Alcatraz. And so do tell, what was it like? And do you have a new fondness for prison?
I do. Yeah, I do. A new fondness for prison, better than my old fondness for prison. That's for sure. Jeff, I got to tell you, thanks to Len for mentioning that. And thanks to you and Brendan for having me on. I am staring out at what might be the greatest view in baseball. I'm sitting right underneath the radio broadcast booth right now in the seats, staring out at the bay, Alcatraz behind us. Mm. My love for Alcatraz, or my desire to go see it rather, was from the, I want to say 1994 Mike Myers movie, So I Married an Axe Murderer. There's a scene in which he and his friend go visit Alcatraz. Phil Hartman, the legendary Phil Hartman, is the prison guard in that scene. It is hysterical and one of my favorite movies of all time. I've watched it no fewer than 700 times. And since then, I've always wanted to go. And I took a photo of me in the prison. I sent it to my friends. But everybody here just calls me Vicky, which is the line that Phil Hartman gives in the movie. It was really cool. Jeff, there is a baseball field sort of in the prison. There's a recreational yard, mostly concrete with a little bit of grass. And there is still a home plate and a couple of bases in this, you know, shelled out grass yard. The members of the Milwaukee Braves, the Boston Red Sox, and I think the Cardinals in 1952 came to visit the prison and played in this baseball yard while prisoners were still, you know, actively serving time at Alcatraz, which I had no idea of the baseball connection to the penitentiary. And it was a really cool trip. I'm glad I did it. It's definitely a bucket list for me.
No, it sounds pretty cool. And it's definitely something that I would like to do as well at some point. So glad to hear that. You're right. Oracle Park definitely is one of the better looking parks, at least on television, and hearing you talk about the view, no doubt, makes me want to go there as well. I guess the question is, as you're sitting out there, Connor, are you tarps on or tarps off right now?
Tarps on right now. Tarps on always. Okay. I think it might be in my contract that the tarp must always stay on the body, which I included. I thought that was a better idea than not. But it's sweeping the nation, isn't it?
It is. We were talking about it a little bit earlier, and it's, I mean, listen, hey, it's good fun. Nobody's getting hurt, so go ahead, have at it. It's interesting to see how, like, a small group can multiply and expand, you know, from the third inning into the seventh. Especially, hey, if your team's losing by 9 runs, why not take your shirt off and have a good time, I guess, right?
I remember looking around the ballpark and, you know, obviously situated in the camera well as I was, there were a lot of White Sox players I could tell that were, you know, had their eyes going around the ballpark too. And I thought, you know, they don't have much else to do. You might as well get into it. They're getting shelled in this one. And it was, it's certainly a lot of fun, a cool atmosphere, even though it was pretty chilly last night.
Yeah. Yeah. No doubt about it. All right. So, what did you make of last night? It was an interesting game because the White Sox were mowed down the first time through the order by McDonald. And then second time through, I mean, talk about your second time through the order penalty. It did not wait very long because the White Sox put 9 on them in the fourth. And after that, they just, I guess, kicked their feet up and cruised to victory for Davis Martin. What'd you make of last night's game? Any takeaways?
Yeah, it's funny. You know, I think the biggest takeaway for me is Munetaka Murakami really getting some ride on that ball out of the left field corner. Gordon pointed it out on a television broadcast, Gordon Beckham at the time. You know, if that hit doesn't happen, right, it feels a lot more like a 5-4 win last night, which probably necessitates Grant Taylor and maybe Dominguez in some sort of order, using the A-arms in the bullpen.
Yep.
And not being, I mean, credit to Brandon Eichert and Trevor Richards, they both pitched well and handled their assignments. But, you know, off day yesterday, you used the pen a little bit in Seattle. You've come out with just one win instead of two or maybe even three in a close series. And now, because you land that knockout punch early on in the ballgame, and yes, San Francisco chipped away at some things and were able to get, you know, a few runs across the board against Davis Martin, which no one has really been able to do this year. You were able to use some, you know, less than A arms in the bullpen. No shots at either Eichert or Richards. These are their jobs in the pen. They know that. And you come out of that win looking not only glowing in the bullpen and ready to go for today and being able to use Hudson as an opener today for Eric Fetty, but also feeling like your offense passed the baton, really showed out when they needed to. I thought it was, you know, Sam Antonacci is the first White Sox in franchise history to be hit by a pitch in the same inning twice. Mm-hmm. It's never happened before. We've been playing baseball for a long time. I asked him about it after the game, and all he said was, cool, which is just very classic Sam, right? Yeah, great. Now I'll go for three next time, that kind of thing. It was an inning full of fun facts and a needed win for this team, too. Not that they've been playing badly, Jeff, as you know, but after the, you know, two or three kind of went sideways on his, in Seattle, you might as well just put one away early, and they did.
No doubt about it. And that was, you know, I had a very similar thought last night on the postgame show. Was my biggest takeaway was they didn't use the arms in the bullpen. You know, you put nine up on them. And yes, to your point, yes, you know, Tyler Davis, hey, he keep pitching like you're a pitching kid. You may work your way into the A relievers, but nevertheless, it puts them in great position, not just to win the series, but maybe even sweep it against a San Francisco Giants team that is really about as down as they could be right now. So hopefully the Sox can take advantage of it. But that leads me to a couple things. So Antonacci hit for the 9th and 10th time in the 4th inning. I mean, and I think anybody who's watched and listened now, you know, Sam Antonacci, this is a skill. It is truly the way he leans in to cover the plate, and then he kind of turns away, but he almost turns away more over the plate so that he is creating the ability to be clipped by pitches at a high rate. And in the leadoff position, I mean, it is an extremely underrated skill that I don't think can, you know, you can underestimate just what that is. He's been walked 8 times, Connor, but 10 hit by pitches for a .390 on base percentage.
You know, it's something that Hawk Harrelson talked about years ago on MLB Network, and I will raise my hand and point the thumb on this one. Those of us who were sabermetrically inclined, we gave Hawk some crap about this over the will to win, right? TWTW. And he was so right in his own way. He really was. And Sam displays some of that. You have to want to. You have to care. You have to have that, you know, whatever it is, unquenchable desire to do it. I don't think you can quantify it that way. And in some ways, you can, right? I mean, listen, he's on base. The on-base percentage is up there. What does sabermetrics love as much as anything else? Not making outs, right? We've known that since 2002 when Moneyball got released. But at the same time, it's stuff like that. It's stuff like being able to reach on error, right? I think we know now that by and large, being able to do that at a high rate can be a skill set because you've got speed out of the batter's box, because you're able to bust it down the line, and maybe because you're left-handed, that helps too. So I think it's this, listen, we keep on talking about this clubhouse as one that's willing to do anything it takes to win a ball game. It's willing to do anything it can to support those in the lineup today to win that ball game. Well, you also have to have sacrifice to get there. And Antonacci is one of those guys who want to lay it on the line like that.
Connor McKnight of CHSN joining me here on White Sox Weekly. He's out in San Francisco as we get set for a 3:05 first pitch today. Pre-game coverage officially starting at 2:30 here on ESPN 1000. All right, Connor, Grant Taylor, he is undoubtedly not just an A reliever, but probably the most feared arm in that pen and the most trusted arm that Will Venable can turn to. The conversations have started, you know, about him potentially being the capital C closer. And I'll admit that I have resisted that idea because I love the versatility of being able to use him in higher leverage situations. However, when you start to look at what he's been able to do over his last 14 innings, where he struck out 22 and has basically gone on a Mason Miller-esque run, I guess I'll ask the question, should those of us who are maybe more analytically inclined be a little more open to the idea that he should be the White Sox closer?
Well, I'll put it this way. Probably, yes. I'm not there yet. And it's because it has nothing to do with Grant's ability or Sir Anthony Dominguez's ability. It has everything to do with, for me, with a stated goal that Chris Getz had put out there a couple of weeks ago, maybe a month and a half ago now, to be honest with you. It's been a minute. And it's wanting to get Grant Taylor to 100 innings. And I think regardless of how well the White Sox are playing, you know, since the middle of last month, winning a bunch of games and looking as good as they have in a long time, I think if you make someone the capital C closer, in a weird way, it restricts that player's use, right?
Yep.
You're kind of beholden to the save stat. We talked about this for a long time in this game. And for a guy who is as able to pitch multiple innings as Grant Taylor is, and a guy who, you know, they really want to get to that 100-inning mark, I just think that it restricts his ability to develop, which at the end of the day is the biggest goal here in 2026. And you can do, this is what the best teams do. And you know this, Jeff. What the best teams do is thread the needle. You can develop your players, regardless of who those are, while you are making a move to compete in your division. The Brewers do this. The Guardians have done this. I mean, you can't tell. Look at that bullpen after they lose Emmanuel Clase. Turn it over to the guys they turned it over. You can't tell me that that wasn't also player development and looking to win ballgames. It absolutely was. And if you can't walk and chew bubblegum in this game as a front office, you are not going to get yourself to where you want to go long term. And I really think that getting Taylor to that mark of 100 innings and being flexible with these issues in bullpen, and putting him in there for some classic three-out saves with a three-run lead and nobody on, sure, everybody deserves, you know, a nice little Sunday afternoon at the ballpark every now and again. You can do all of those things, but you must display that you can walk and chew bubblegum at the same time, and that's very much part of what they're trying to accomplish here, I think.
Last one for you, Connor, as I let you go here. So Brian Hudson used as the opener today, the 6'8" lefty, and Eric Fetty will be the bulk man after he's done. I'm curious, if things go perfectly and it's a 1-2-3 first and you've got Devers, the lefty, hitting cleanup, do you think Will would send Hudson out for an extra batter to start the second, and then does that compromise Eric Fetty from just starting an inning? You know, we know how the opener starter game is played.
Yeah, they're willing to do that. They're willing to throw Fetty into, or not Fetty specifically, but, you know, they're willing to throw the bulk guy, the headliner, into a clogged inning if they need to. Just kind of looking at the lineup, you got to remember Willie Adames is a bit of a reverse split guy as a right-hander. He actually hits righties better than lefties. Looking through, I don't know, doesn't that Matt Chapman at bat kind of scream, here's Eric Fetty on to, you know, start his day of work? Chapman's hitting, I shouldn't do math on the air and count, but let's do it together, shall we? Adames first, Rise,
Schmidt, Devers. Yeah, he's the fifth hitter. Yeah,
that's your fifth hitter. I think that's probably your spot there for him. And the White Sox haven't had to use an opener for a little while because, for the most part, starting pitching has been good. Hudson's, and listen, you mentioned it on the post game last night, not having to use that A bullpen, of which Brian Hudson is a part, allows you to go to Hudson here and kind of set this up for you in game two and perhaps take a series early. So, you know, more flexibility there. You get pitching flexibility because of the offensive outburst. It lines up really well. This is a very nice little Saturday here at the ballpark on paper. We'll see if the White Sox convert. But yeah, I think that Chapman at bat is probably where you see Fetty come in.
I just don't know if we'll have time, Connor, but thank you for your time. Keep the shirt on, my friend, for the CHSM broadcast. Tarps on for you.
No concern there whatsoever. This tarp is stapled to my chest. Don't worry about it.
All right, that sounds painful. Connor McKnight of CHSN joining us. Thanks for his time, as always. Hey, Sox fans. Learn from the pros this summer at a White Sox summer camp. Starting at $165, kids ages 5 through 12 can register for a 4-day baseball camp. Campers will receive a Sox swag bag with a White Sox branded compression arm sleeve, 2 tickets for a 2026 White Sox home game, and more. To learn more, visit whitesox.com/camps. Jeff Meller here on White Sox Weekly. When we come back, I do have some interesting numbers courtesy of Hembo from ESPN regarding this Giants lineup that we, Connor and I, were just kind of working our way through, and part of the reason why they have struggled so much this year. I'll share that with you when we come back right here on the ESPN 1000 Hard Rock Casino White Sox Network.
Sox games on the go, the ESPN Chicago app.
Time run at third. Caro hits a fly ball out into deep left center field. It's back there. It is gone! Edgar Caro wins it!
Shut up! Yes! The young man deserves it.
Ah, to the tune of Don't Stop Believin' by Journey, a San Francisco band. Figured we'd give Caro one more spin, that home run from last Sunday. One more spin, at least for the week of, here on White Sox Weekly. Jeff Meller back with you on the home of the White Sox, ESPN Chicago. Again, each and every Saturday, we're with you 2 hours prior to our pregame coverage of all Sox games. And the pregame officially starts at 2:30 today. 3:05, first pitch in San Francisco as the White Sox take on the Giants in game two of three. This is the White Sox final West Coast trip of the season, which means that because today's an afternoon game, tomorrow's an afternoon game, no more West Coast baseball, White Sox fans, at least if you're going to watch the White Sox play, not till next year. So for me, that's always a little bit sad because I do like late night West Coast baseball, but I know lots of Midwesterners out there do need to get their sleep and can't always make it through. So that is a little bit of a good news for you there. No more late nights, at least when it comes to the Sox on the West Coast. Hey, Sox fans, join us at the ballpark on Memorial Day. That is Monday, May 25th, as the White Sox take on the Twins at 1:10. They come back to town after this series in San Fran. 10,000 fans at the ballpark will receive a Chase Meidroth bobblehead presented by the Village of Bedford Park. To purchase tickets and prepaid parking, visit whitesox.com/promos. I did want to play this for the folks out there. If you're wondering part of the reason of why the San Francisco Giants have underperformed so much this season, I think Hembo laid it out pretty well on Baseball Tonight with Buster Olney the other day.
5.7% of their plate appearances have resulted in a walk. The league, as we've discussed, is walking at a higher level. It's 9.4% right now. So if we're going to do a little back-of-the-napkin math, on a scale for which 100 is average, the Giants' league-adjusted walk rate is 63. That figure, 63, renders the Giants as the most walk-averse lineup since 1879. Buster, the Giants are the most allergic to walk team in 147 years. My first assumption was, naturally, they swing more than anybody else. That's not true. There are three teams in baseball that swing more than they do. My second assumption was that they chase more than anybody else, which is also not true. There are three teams in baseball that chase more than the Giants do. So as it turns out, Buster, the Giants are so walk-averse because their lineup doesn't elicit any fear.
Right.
They have seen a higher rate of pitches inside the strike zone than any team in baseball, and it is by a considerable margin. That number is 49%, which skyrockets to 58% in hitters counts, counts in which they have the lowest OPS in baseball by 37 percentage points.
Takeaway here, the Giants, who struggle to hit home runs, you just attack their hitters. And that is exactly what Davis Martin did last night. That's exactly what Tyler Davis did in relief for him last night. Brian Hudson, who will be the opener today, hopefully he got the memo as well. And I think more importantly, hopefully Eric Fetty did as well, because the key for Fetty is going to be, hey, challenge those Giants hitters and make them hit you. Do not give them free passes, because they certainly don't want to take them. So there's no reason why you should be forcing them to take them. Quick scoreboard before we get out of here for our pregame coverage. The Astros up on the Cubs, 3-0 early in that one as they head to the fifth inning in that game at Wrigley Field. Of course, the Astros won yesterday. Christian Walker with a pair of home runs already in that one against the Cubs, as the Astros are winning there. The Cardinals are winning the first game of their doubleheader today. They had yesterday's game postponed. Cardinals up on the Reds 6-1 in Cincinnati right now. That game is headed to the bottom of the eighth. And the Blue Jays have homered off of Paul Skenes' first hitter, George Springer, leadoff home run against Skenes. So Jays up 1-0 on the Pirates in the top of the second there. Everything else still yet to get started. Obviously, we'll keep you apprised of what's going on around the majors here on the White Sox broadcast, coming up here in just about 4 minutes from now. Thank you to Hannah LaMotta and Brendan Riley for their help producing White Sox Weekly this week. I'm Jeff Meller, and hang tight. We'll talk to you in 4 minutes and get the pregame coverage going right here on the ESPN 1000 Hard Rock Casino White Sox Network.
The worry of what could happen. It's overwhelming. Petco Love Lost is here to help. This free, nonprofit-powered service uses photo-matching technology to search the largest national lost and found pet database, including pets from shelters, neighbors, and social media, helping bring pets back to the people who love them. And it works. Every day, Petco Love Lost reunites pets with their families. A reunion happens every 4 minutes. Simply upload a photo of your lost pet, or one you found, and Petco Love Lost's photo-matching technology goes to work instantly. You can even register your pet in advance, so if the unthinkable happens, reporting them lost and helping bring them home is as easy as the click of a button. Every pet deserves a way home. Visit PetcoLoveLost.org to register your pet or upload a photo and search for a lost or found pet today.
When a child is struggling with their mental health, the adults around them can make all the difference. Parents, teachers, coaches, anyone who shows up in a child's life. Because in those tough moments, kids are looking to the grown-ups around them for support.
If you're at school having a bad day, you just don't want to do anything.
I just get these thoughts like, too bad.